I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today on the podcast, I'm excited to have Leah Huber. Is it Huber? Huber.
You got it. Huber.
No, you're always supposed to ask how to pronounce before you hit record, but you know me. Yes. So here I am, Leah Huber. She's a food writer, recipe developer, and a consultant whose work has appeared in Cooking Light. You might have read some of her articles in Cooking Light, Bon Appetit, Better Homes and Gardens, Eating Well, and Prevention. She's the founder and CEO of Nourish Evolution. I want to find out more about that, which I'm sure we will, and for which she was named Entrepreneur of the Year in 2012, so not all that long ago, by the International Association of Culinary Professionals. It's pretty exciting. And so, when she's and of the subscription-based real food community and online meal planner, Cook the Seasons. Whew, I missed that somehow before, so I want to ask about that too. So she speaks all over the place about food, faith, and entrepreneurship, and I'm excited to talk to her today about her memoir titled Nourished. I mean, the title just kind of pulled me in like that, pretty much sucked me in. A memoir of food, faith, and enduring love, and with some really lovely recipes along the way. So, Leah, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Thank you so much, Anita. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you for a couple of reasons. One, who doesn't like to talk about food? But beyond that, the trajectory of your life has been fascinating. And one that I'm glad you put in memoir form.
I think
really interesting. And of course, you're a beautiful writer. And
thank you.
You would not have been writing in all those magazines if that weren't the case. And you have to be a good writer to write about food, because that takes a certain amount of creativity, of fill in the adjectives there. But, you know, all of us, we've been watching all kinds of food channels through the years.
Yeah.
And so we know that you've got to really be able to explain flavor and texture, and you've got to be able to do that well.
I think it's a multi-sensual approach, you know, where and this is what I love about writing, not just about food, but about everything, is really attacking it from all the different senses. So I try and place myself in that place and then really sort of describe everything that's going on from each of the senses. You know, what's it sound like? What's it taste like? What's it feel like? What does it look like? All of those different things. What's it sound like? All of those different things.
Exactly.
And really create this very multi-textural experience in the reading, you know?
Oh, well, and that's what draws people in and brings us along. And if you don't do that, you know, you lose readers right away. So you've been doing this. You know how to do it. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
I want to know how many years Nourished covers. Sometimes in the book you flip back and forth, but in a very logical way. I mean, it's a storytelling way. But how many years does this book cover for you?
It covers roughly 20 years. And it was really interesting getting to that, because the first iteration of this book, in my mind, this book was about the time when my husband and I pulled up stakes and drove to Costa Rica, and that journey that was very much
huge,
a physical journey. Yeah. It was an 8,000-mile road trip there and back. But it was also really a pivotal time in both of our lives. And that was what I originally wanted to write about. And so I wrote a book proposal on that, and I took it to my agent. And my agent said, this is great. This is going to be a lovely few chapters. She said, we need more.
But
we need more of,
so you know, the big
why
but.
Exactly. Mm. And, right? You know, why did you do this? What provoked it? Mm. What provoked your change in food? What were you like before that? How did it affect your life afterwards? How did your faith come into it? Like, all these things. And I thought, oh, God, you're kidding me.
I thought this was going to be easier, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Well,
so that started. I mean, that was a 2-year endeavor in and of itself, just to figure out where to begin, mm-hmm. where to end, mm-hmm. and what to include. And that was literally a 2-year endeavor before I even began writing.
I believe it.
Yeah, so it's a lot.
That propels me to where I think we have to begin, which is where you begin in your book, mm-hmm. The Summer That Changed Everything. Because, I mean, that really does foundationally set the story going.
Yes, for sure.
You landed in Greece. Mm-hmm. And I think you've got to tell us about that, specifically the island of Corfu, right?
Specifically the island of Corfu,
which that alone just sounds romantic and lovely, and it certainly has some of that as part of the story. But what was it about that time of life for you that started to set things in motion, really, for much of your life?
Yeah. Well, it was a very interesting time. It was just after I had spent a year studying in Paris at the Sorbonne, and my friend and I were traveling through Europe and stopped in Corfu. And early on, I met a man there who owned a restaurant. And he brought me into his life in a way that I met his family. I, you know, went to his home. He took me to these ancestral lands up on top of this beautiful mountain. And I was sort of woven into the fabric of this Greek family very early on. And I ended up opting to stay the summer with them. And it was such an incredible experience to be living in this small village on this Greek island, working at this restaurant with them. I eventually ended up caring for his father, who had a heart attack. And we had this incredible bond, even though neither of us spoke each other's language. And just really being exposed to this sort of unconditional love that was growing between all of this family and myself. And also at the same time being exposed really for the first time, even after living in Paris, to very, very simple foods in their purest form. And I had this very transformative experience. One of my first mornings there when Mama fried an egg. And I literally just about fell out of my seat. It was so full of flavor. And, when I cut into it, the yolk was like cake batter. It was so thick and rich and orangey gold. And I couldn't figure out what she'd done to it. And she kept saying, "I just fried an egg in olive oil," you know.
Yes.
And now looking back, I realize it's because it was an egg from the neighbor's hens.
Right.
And it was the olive oil that was in the ouzo bottle that was next to the stove that was pressed from the family's grove down the street, you know. But at the time, I didn't understand it. But it was a seed that was planted that eventually unfurled and stayed with me and grew into really the template and the picture of what I wanted my life to be like, and eventually the way that I wanted to eat, not just what I wanted to eat, but the whole experience and picture of how I wanted to be nourished.
You know, it's interesting. I kind of laughed as you described being folded into this family, because as I was reading, I kept thinking, wow, it's my big fat Greek wedding. It's like really real, this whole Greek family experience.
Yeah, you know,
And beautiful as well.
Yeah.
You know, just this full orbed experience.
Very much.
I think I loved this, so I underlined where you said, but the most significant meal of my life during that time in my whole life, really, didn't involve suckling pig or a fancy restaurant. In fact, it didn't even happen at a table. It was simply a cube of bread and a little cup of grape juice. Now, this is moving on from this period of time. I was thinking this was in that first chapter, but it's not, because you came away, you had to go back to school. First of all, you had to go back to school and make some decisions of whether you would return to Greece or not. And, you know, we don't want to give everything away, but you moved on from that point in time and actually, well, you did return to Greece at some point.
At some point.
Yes.
Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, exactly. But at that point, you moved on to school. And where were you at that point in time after you left Corfu?
Yeah, I went back to my last year in school in New Orleans at Tulane.
Thank you.
And then I graduated, and I did not go back to Greece then. And I was sort of thrust into this this reality of, oh my gosh, I have no plan. You know, my plan was to go back to Greece and build a life there. And so I did not end up doing that. which I decided about 5 days before graduation. So yeah. That was interesting.
Which does leave you with no plan, right?
It leaves you with no plan. Mm-hmm. It also, it's funny because my parents had all through college, they'd always said, you know, this golden rod is going to come down on graduation and going to cut you off financially. And you're going to have to go Ooh. Your own way. And you're not going to come live with us. This is, you know,
I kind of said that to my son.
See, exactly. But the key is if you're engaged to somebody who lives in a foreign country your entire senior year, and then you break it off 5 days before graduation, that golden rod doesn't come down.
Oh, that's
and you're
great.
Like, Mom, Dad, I don't know what I'm going to do. Can I come live with you? Yeah. And they say, yes, absolutely,
yes.
You can.
In the end, love prevails from the parents,
totally.
Right?
Yeah, But I ended up in New York City, and I was just incredibly blessed to meet this woman at work, Julie, who became my very dearest friend and still is to this day. And we ended up moving in together, and she was a Christian. And I was going through a period in my life where I was really seeking. I'd always felt this kernel of something of God. I'd always felt a kernel of God, but I never felt like in any of my church experiences growing up, I always felt like an outsider and like I just didn't belong or I was doing something wrong. I was very much the square peg in the round hole or the round peg in the square hole, whichever one. It just didn't fit. And none of those experiences fit the impression that I had of God. And so there was sort of this really interesting search that was going on for me where I felt very strongly this call, you know, this deeper call, but I couldn't put shape or form or words to it. And when I met Julie, she would be doing her Bible study at one end of the couch, and I was sort of on this alternative path, exploring in the New Age directions and things like that. And I would be doing that. Little did I know that she and her whole prayer team were praying for me at the time. Now I do know that. But I eventually started going to church with her. And in large part because the pastor was the brother of one of our mutual friends. And we were all in a wine club together. We lived in New York City. We used to go hang out with them. Like, it was a very approachable place to me. And I really liked the people that were at that church, and they weren't intimidating, and I could argue and argue and argue with the pastor, and he wouldn't get offended or he wouldn't make me feel stupid. It was just, I'm a big questioner. And so I felt like that was a safe place for me to go and to be me and not be shoehorned into something that I wasn't.
And to me, that was a super exciting piece of the story because, man, there are a million other places you could have been where you would have been shut down in a New York minute.
So
totally. I read that beautiful quote like about, I don't know how many years too early here in our conversation, but I remember the fact that, you know, they would have communion at church and you would always stay put. You would stay,
yes.
You know, you would go to church. You were going with Julian, but you would not, wouldn't partake in communion. You sat there until one day.
Until one day. Yeah. Keith was always very clear that communion is a special act to be had between those that believed. And I was very clear that I was not one who believed. And so I very respectfully, you know, just sat it out. And one day it was so clear. It was as if somebody had tapped me on the shoulder and said, get up. Mm. And I remember looking over my shoulder and being like, what is that? You know? Oh, what's happening here? And it's sort of where you feel like you're standing and you're like, what am I doing? What am I doing? What am I doing? And it just felt more right to get up and stand and go to the front and be fed than it did to stay sitting. I think it's really interesting in my own experience in my life, my experiences, my big aha experiences tend not to be 100% over the top experiences. They tend to be at the tip over the 50% mark. You know, so this was a 51% stand.
Yes.
This was not 100% stand,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
And so I was not there yet. I was not ready. And this was not I went to the front and said, Jesus is my savior at all.
Yep.
I went to the front going, what am I doing? What am I doing? What am I doing? But then as soon as I took that communion and I took that bread into my body and I took that juice into my body, I felt profoundly touched. I mean, it was, I think I say in the book, like neon streaks of love going through my body. And it felt like that.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what was going on. And it was so disconcerting. And I wasn't ready for it. I wasn't prepared for it at all. But it definitely stuck with me and made a huge impression with me. And
now, you know, in the appropriate timing, I will read a different paragraph here that says, "Little did I know how sustaining that simple meal would be. My path in life would lead me to other continents, across the country." You know, you go on to say several things. Yet the bread and the wine, albeit grape juice, I was introduced to that morning would be the meal I would come back to again and again to nourish my soul and satiate my hunger, the hunger. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, the beauty of that, too, is someone who's involved with food and would be involved with food your entire life still are, you know, there's such beauty in that. I think some of us don't have the same poetic sense. And so I love that.
Thank you.
What happened next? You know, where did you go from there? You know, you didn't dive in head first, but this was still very meaningful. And so where next?
Well, and it's interesting because as much as I don't dive head first, God plunges me in head first. So that was probably early fall that happened. And a few weeks later in November, I can't remember the exact date, and I wish I did, but I went in to argue with Keith, with the pastor, again, about some point of why New Age was just as valid as Christianity. And he, again, just, you know, gave me answers that were just very solid and very made a lot of sense to me. And then he just asked me a question. He said, "Leah, do you believe in God?" And I said, "Yes, I do." Because I did. I really believed in God. And he said, "What do you think he's saying to you right now?" And I was quiet. And I felt so clearly. And it was kind of a continuation of that opening that had begun when I stood for communion and took the body and the blood into me. I felt so clearly that God was saying, "Jesus is the way. You know, Jesus is the way and the truth and the life, and you need to say yes to him." Mm-hmm. And I looked up at Keith and I said, "He's saying to say yes to Jesus." And that was my moment. Mm-hmm. But in my head, there was this chorus of, you know, "You're crazy. Oh my gosh." I mean, because you have to understand, I'm coming from a background of, my dad is a devout atheist. And my mom is from a Presbyterian background, but we would kind of sporadically go to church. Yes. And this was like, I had very bad experiences with church growing up. So it was just not my thing. And it was not, I had a very specific image in my mind of what a quote unquote Christian was. And that was, I was not it. I mean, I was not it. You know, I was the black mini skirt and the python boot girl, you know?
It's great. And I love it.
I was a rebel. And, so I'm thinking, and I'm like, "Oh my gosh, my dad's not going to talk to me." My friend, I didn't have Christian friends outside of Julie and a couple from church. My life was not at all what a life is of if you grow up in the faith.
Or, sure.
You know, it did not look like that. So all of these things are going on in my head simultaneously. And I'm sort of thinking, "Oh my gosh, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and be like, what did I do? Or that's so silly or whatever. Like, this isn't going to stick." Could not have been further from the truth. I mean, it was from the moment I opened my eyes the next day, my life was radically, radically different.
Well,
and to this day.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this was 25 years ago. And to this day, there has been not one ounce of wavering in my faith. And I still look back to that moment and I look at how radically different my life is now than it would have been if I had not said yes. And everything started to change immediately. It was like God just took this big honking chisel to this, you know, rock me, and just started hammering away immediately.
Read in your book underlined where you said, "I don't know how to explain it. How does one explain the experience of being rebuilt from the inside out?" And I think there are a lot of us that know that. And yet the beauty of that is that it looks different for everyone.
For everybody, totally.
You know, we all come to this faith life with a different family, different friends, different life experiences, and not sure what walking forward will look like. And,
yes.
You know, and so that's the beauty of everyone's story. And so
it
what did walking forward look like for you?
It looked like being carried in the beginning, very much so, just in faith, and waking up every day and recognizing I was having to sort of rediscover myself in God's image every day. I used to swear like a sailor up until that moment that I went in and said yes to Keith, and then woke up the next morning. And I mean, and people had tried for years to get me to stop, and I would tell them to F off. You know, it was like, it just didn't work.
Yeah.
And the next day, what I recognized was it was no longer of me. That wasn't a part of myself anymore. So something I had defended as part of my character and who I was, dang it, you know, it suddenly didn't fit anymore. And so it felt awkward and weird and bumbling coming out of my mouth. So it was something, you know, that's one example of this cascade of things that were just falling away from my character, or from what I thought was my character. And I was being reshaped in God's image. And shortly after that, I met the man that would become my husband.
Just going to ask. He was in this story right around here, but I couldn't remember if it was before or after.
Okay. Yeah, it was just a couple of months after. So I was a brand new, fresh Christian, still very much not comfortable even admitting to people that I was.
Well, I wondered also, and I don't, because I don't know that I read about this, and I don't know if you write about your parents in this at all.
And how, not much.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I didn't know if you said much to them or how that went or what you said or if you wrote about that. But you met this young man, and where was he in the whole faith scene?
Well, it turns out that he was very much in the same place as I was, just a couple steps behind. But I was set up on a blind date with him that was sort of a bungled blind date from the beginning. which you'll have to read the book to find out details on that. Yeah. But we ended up across the table from each other talking deep talks, but it was all around sort of new age spiritual stuff. And I could hang with that because that's where I'd come from. And that's where he was. Mm. But then eventually I was tired of talking about that. I had so many things happening within me as this brand new Christian that was being transformed. That's what I wanted to talk about. Mm. So I finally just like set down my wine glass and I looked at it and I said, so I just became a Christian. What do you think about that? And I was like,
I love that. What do you think about that?
What do you think about that? And, you know, and this was a friend, a mutual friend of a colleague of mine who is a gay colleague. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, Peter's going to find out and he's going to think that I'm a freak. Like all these things went through my head. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've just ruined everything. And instead, I looked up and Christopher was crying.
Mm.
And he said, oh my gosh, I can't believe you just said that, because the last couple of months I've been going to church and sitting in the back pew and just crying and just weeping because I feel like that's where I'm supposed to be, but I don't know how to get there. And he said, would you believe that I even prayed coming here? I prayed for an angel to show me a church to go to in New York City.
Wow.
And so I took him to my church that Sunday, and he accepted Christ on the plane on the way home, basically. And then we were married in that church a year later.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's.
Yeah.
But, not but. And then, the adventure continues, because where were you in your career at that point in time? You were, you know, you had a variety of schooling in your background.
Yeah.
And had this food interest. But somewhere along the line, too, you start talking about your physical health in here, because there are some real things, real scary things that began happening to you.
Yeah. Yeah. During that time, I was in my 20s and I was going downhill pretty fast physically.
Wow. So young. I think your age just kind of shook me. I thought, what?
Yeah.
But I know there are some people listening that are going to identify with this. So yeah.
Yeah. It's really scary. And to get specific, it was, I was really struggling with soreness, my whole body being sore and stiff to the point where I would kind of hobble. It was hard to walk. My knees just throbbed so much. I couldn't unscrew the toothpaste cap in the morning. My fingers would be so stiff and sore. And then that, of course, leads to exhaustion, just constant exhaustion, which then sort of spirals into a depression. So I was struggling with a lot of that. And doctors didn't know what to make of it. I was just sort of shuttled from doctor to doctor and given different medicines and different shots and different this and that. And when nothing worked, they would kind of look at me and it's this horrible feeling when doctors look at you and they feel like they make you feel like you're making it up.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No.
And so it's a really horrible
feeling. And I was making this guess in my mind as I'm reading it, but I'm also realizing that I'm reading this, and this was 20 years in the past or however many years in the past, when you start describing these kind of symptoms today to a doctor, they have a much better clue of what's going on, don't you think?
Yes, to some extent. It's amazing, though, still how many doctors, like, I mean, I can't tell you. Okay. I still go to doctors and they're like, fibromyalgia, right.
You know, really? Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I ended up going through... It was a very hard time, and it was really a struggle with my body. And I was struggling with so much fear also, because I was in my 20s and I kept thinking, my God, if this is what I'm like in my 20s, what am I going to be like in my
60s, 40s, 60s, 70s,
80s, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so it was really, really scary. So after Christopher and I got married and moved to California, I went to a doctor who diagnosed me with lupus.
Yeah.
And the life-threatening... Yeah. Systemic lupus. And that was a hit.
Oh yeah.
And it was, you know, for anybody that has sat across from a doctor and had the doctor say, you need to change the way you live and change the way you eat, or there's a real chance that you're going to die. You know, you wake up and you go, okay, something's got to change big time.
Yeah. Five words, real chance you're going to die. That changes everything.
That is a gun up against your back. Totally. So that got me, it got me questioning, because they don't tell you, here's the interesting thing, is they don't tell you how to do that, you know? And we're hit with so many different diet advice.
Right.
Right? Right. So much diet advice that you're like, eat broccoli. No, broccoli's toxic. Eat fat. No. And I was just like, what am I supposed to really be doing? So because I was already a writer, I leaned into that and started asking for nutrition-focused assignments and spoke with really experts around the world to get to the crux and the answer to that question. Hmm. And the answer was really, like, crazily simple, which was essentially eat a lot of seasonal vegetables cooked with healthy fats, with whole grains, and then have, you know, protein that you feel good about where it's come from. It's sort of like the side dish. Like, that's the side, the veggies are the main, you know? At which, looking back, that's how we ate in Greece.
I was just thinking, you know, yeah.
And yeah,
coming
totally.
From, you know, just also the chickens in the neighbor's yard. I mean, exactly. Yep. Protein where you know where it's come from.
Yep, totally. And the veggies that are grown in the backyard and the olive oil. And, you know, so it was very much, you know, what I'd experienced there. And this was across the board. This was, no matter whether I was talking to somebody from Japan, from Greece, from Harvard. And that was the formula. Mm. And then my thing was, I hated vegetables for the most part. Hated vegetables.
I didn't remember reading that. Okay.
Oh,
all right.
Yeah. I'm not sure how much I should have probably made that a bigger deal in the book, because I was like the quintessential junk food queen and meat and potatoes queen. Mm. And so I had to retrain myself and figure out how to make vegetables enjoyable and how to get pleasure out of them rather than it being a sentence, you know, to this life of boring salads and dreary steamed broccoli.
Yes.
You know?
There's so much there, which, of course, you have found that, but that was its own journey. Well, we got to press forward here. I love getting into the nitty gritty, but let's move forward to you and Christopher going on this 8,000 mile trek. I mean, what propelled you to do that?
Well, there was the lupus diagnosis, which was one sort of pin that gave way. And then a year later, I was faced with a cancer scare, bad cancer scare that ended up in a hysterectomy, a pretty quick decision on a hysterectomy, because it was a scary type of precancerous stuff that we were dealing with. And after having gone through both of those, we just both felt like, what? You know, it was a...
How much life do we have left? You know, do you start thinking those things, you know?
Absolutely, you do. And it's also, Christopher was on the road a lot traveling throughout our whole marriage up to that point. He'd been on the road traveling. And so we kind of felt like we wanted to recalibrate. We wanted to spend time together. I felt like I just needed to hit pause on life and figure out who I was again, you know, and have God kind of do another rebuilding.
But wasn't that scary? I think sometimes we think we want to do that, but wow, to pull up stakes, to quit where we were, whatever. Yeah. Yes. So I think that's an important piece of this too, is really having this sense of what God is moving you toward, and that all out empty, open-handed trust. Because I think often in the West, we don't always know what that kind of life fully looks like, because we can kind of hang on our own resources and, you know, not trust.
I completely agree. I totally agree. And I would actually consider what we went through with the cancer scare in particular. That was, I can say this looking back, it was scary going through it, but looking back, that was a blessing because for so many reasons. But one of them I would say is that God's presence was so clear to me through all of that. And it was a really, really, really visceral lesson that God is with us. It was an Emmanuel experience. And it wasn't, he's not with us in the worry, you know, he's not with us in the fear. But when we are going through something that we have feared and we've worried about, he is right there in the moment. And it was so clear to me. And so coming through it and knowing that, it was this very rock solid grounding that God is with us. And if he's going to ask us to do something scary, and if we're going to go through any kind of hardship in going through it, he will be there in the hardship. He's not going to lead us someplace and then not be there.
Yeah.
And so there was that. I feel like throughout everything, God just kept building these, or stacking up these building blocks of faith for me that enabled me to trust him to a deeper and deeper and deeper level, and to step into faith and leap into faith with larger and larger leaps.
I loved somewhere in the section, which was, I think, called Roots, you started talking about, you know, that you'd always kind of come to the Bible warily and you know, and you'd not come from, as you already expressed, from a Christian family, Christian background. And then all of a sudden you located Richard Foster's Freedom of Simplicity. And I'm a big Richard Foster fan. And
yes.
Interviewed him in my past radio world and love him. And really that message started speaking to you deeply too, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I was so blessed with some, you know, people like Richard Foster and just authors early on who I feel like were such guides to me and opened up worlds to me that I didn't even know were there. And that was one of them, is this Freedom of Simplicity was one. And he's also got this fantastic compendium called Spiritual Classics.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it's so terrific.
And devotional classics. He's got a...
Yes. Devotional classics. And so I was exposed to so many wonderful sort of desert fathers and Christian mystics. And in their words, I was able to see really more of a perspective of my early experiences with God that were a little more kind of unexplainable and a little more out of the box. And it was really... a great way to connect, a wonderful way to connect. And
I underlined, you said this, according to Foster, the good news was that the process in and of itself, you know, you're talking about this faith life process, or just our journey, all that. You say, according to Foster, the good news was that the process in and of itself is an integral part of the growth, just as the releasing of impurities from bones and scraps is an integral part of extracting flavor. You're talking about, you know, building a stock, a soup here, I think. Mm-hmm. The bad news was it could last quite some time. You know, it's kind of like that journey doesn't end, right? You know, we're in the process for pretty much for life.
For life, exactly. We're continually remade, right? We're continually remade.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I want to move forward to a period of time. You know, there's this incredible journey that takes place, and, you know, I don't want to minimize that. And that, to me, is just a gorgeous part of the book, the writing and also the telling of all of the places that you were and experiences that you had in those places. But you were coming to a place in your own life where you were sensing God speaking to you, but you weren't quite sure what he was speaking to you. Or maybe you were quite sure, but just couldn't even utter it out loud. And this is kind of where I am in the book. I'm like in the dark. I don't know what's happened yet. So it's going to be slight spoiler alert. But, you know, the thing is, you have to read the book to get all of the details. But this is no small thing. When any of us come to a major life decision and we're needing someone to help confirm it, we're needing to hear from God, we're wanting to hear from God. And I find it interesting that often it's already inside us, but we cannot yet give utterance to it.
Totally.
Talk about totally. That process and what happened.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this was, Christopher and I had never been kid people. So when we were getting married and we had the talk of, do we want kids? Both of us came back with a no. And I did not grow up. I played with horses and Tonka trucks instead of Barbie dolls. Yeah. I just was not a kid person.
Were you an only?
No, I have a brother. I have a younger brother.
All right.
Yeah. So I know it just was not sort of in my genes. Yeah. And so when I had the hysterectomy too, that was sort of a confirmation.
Closed
we kind of went kinda. Through. Yeah, yeah. It was like, okay, confirmation. This is God does not want to bear children through us. And thank God it's us going through this as painful as it is. And that it's not a family that God is really calling them to have children. So I had a pretty deep stake in the ground around our choice not to have children. And I thought that once you have a hysterectomy, that people would stop asking. But alas, they don't. So then it was, are you going to adopt? Are you going to do, not in vitro, but the other?
Yes, all kinds of other things.
All kinds of other things.
Yes, trying to think, so too.
You know what I'm saying. And the answer kept coming back, no, no, no. And when you're answering no, no, no so often, I just had a lot of conviction around that because I felt part of me felt offended. I was like, you know, this is my choice. This is not just my choice. This is also what I feel like God has planned for me. And so stop asking, get off my back and get that this is like our choice. So I had a pretty deep stake in the ground. And then I felt the need. My best friend, Julie, was having her third child and she invited me to be there at the birth. And, this was still sort of circling around. People were still asking and something kind of started to swirl around in me around, oh, is there something here? And so I felt the need to go see a spiritual director, of course.
Of course, I love Julie that. People
I know.
On the podcast
well, the
know.
Irony was, the irony was, I didn't even, Julie had, I think, met her once. It wasn't somebody that Julie knew well. It was just something that she'd mentioned in passing.
Wow, wow.
And for some strange reason that God only knows, right. I went, I need to go see that woman. Mm. And I need to go ask her if I'm meant to be a mother or not. Wow. And so I did. And I went in and I did that. And
it's like the things God uses in our lives. It's so often you do look back and it's like, well, this is crazy. But
totally, so totally, you, totally,
so
totally.
You met with her.
So I met with her and most of the time that we were talking, it was all kind of confirmation that no, you know, we don't have to have a child. Like God is definitely going to use your life anyway. And I felt very much that God has planted in me the promise that he would bear creative things through me. Just not creation. And, so that was all confirmed during it. And then at the end we prayed. And as we were praying, God just imparted on me. It was one of those moments where it wasn't a thought. It wasn't a feeling. It was like an impartation where there's sort of eons of knowledge that just are suddenly within you.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, I knew that I was going to be a mother, that I was meant to be a mother. And that also it was going to be a long road between then and when I was going to become a mother, and when even the desire to become a mother was going to start becoming evident, all of that was there.
And well, I'm also thinking, and what is your husband going to say when you share this?
Exactly. Oh, completely, completely. So it was all there. And I looked up and I'm just sobbing so hard that I can't even speak. And she said very calmly, as spiritual directors do, she said, I feel like there's something you want to say.
yeah, it's great. I love it.
And so it took about 5 minutes to catch my breath. And then I said, I think I know the answer. You know, I'm meant to be a mother. And it was the unfolding of everything from there on was a miracle in and of itself, just watching God just lay the steps before us. And I held very loosely to that. It was so tender that I didn't even write it in my journal a year.
I can believe that.
It was just so scary.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't tell Julie, didn't tell Christopher, nothing. And then when I felt really this quickening, and I was in this Bible study, and there was something in particular in the Bible study that was about Moses crossing the river, right?
Yeah, go over the Red Sea. The sea.
The Red Sea.
Parting the Red Sea, yeah.
Right. Gosh, I always get the bodies of water mixed up. Yes, parting the Red Sea.
Yeah.
And how he was called on to really usher people across quickly. And the message being that, like, there are many times in our life when God calls for us to wait patiently. Mm-hmm. And I have been there. I have felt that. But there are also times in our lives when God asks us to act quickly. And that was, I felt very much that's what he was asking me to do. And I literally went home from that Bible study and was like, hi, honey. Yeah.
Guess what God's
I feel like
saying
God
to me?
Put on our heart that we're supposed to be a parent.
And after he came out of his dead faint on the floor, what happened?
Yes. Well, he said he's absolutely not there. And I said that is absolutely okay. Yeah. And I truly, truly left all of this in God's hands and held it so loosely. It was like, Lord, I know all you're asking me to do is to just speak what you're putting on my heart. And I know you're going to change his heart and that this is not about me manipulating my husband at all.
You know how huge that is? I mean, that's just so huge that it's like being responsible for the part that we are responsible for and leaving to God his part, which is so hard. I mean, you're saying it so calmly and beautifully, but that is so hard to live out. You know, so I just don't want that to be lost.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It is. You're right. It totally is. But I also think that that's another confirmation of when we're in the place that God really wants us is that he makes it easier sort of to let go. Maybe not. But
I think it depends. I mean, I think it can't that certainly can happen and does sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
Just depends, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
None of this is universal. It's all so specific with these issues.
So
you know, that's
specific.
The thing. We want a big universal template for everything. Yeah. No, it's not how it works.
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all.
So
totally.
Christopher, did he come around? Did God speak to him?
He did. God spoke to him within a matter of weeks. It was crazy. And it was another one of those 51% experiences.
Love that.
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, Christopher came home from a retreat and just sat down and started weeping himself. Mm. And then he got up and drug his foot across the floor and he said, and then he stepped over it. And he said, I'm at 51%. He said, God has me ready to be a father.
Wow.
You know? Yeah. It was just crazy.
Well, you know, you can't leave us there. We're closing in on the end of the podcast, but there's no way you could leave us there. So I'll let you divulge what you want to divulge, but moving forward from that point, all the power is in your hand.
Well, let's just say that our daughter Noemi just had her 11th birthday.
Oh, wow!
In November.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And the fuller story, which I'm just at that part, so I'm going to keep reading in the book. I love it. The fuller story is in the book. You know, if you were to say to someone, I mean, what really is Nourished about? I mean, it is a memoir, yes, and I personally love the memoir genre. I'm a fan of it. And, you know, I already said there are, because you're in the food writing trade, if you will. I mean, there are beautiful recipes certainly in here at the ends of chapters. But what do you say to people? What, you know, what's Nourished? What's the overarching message of Nourished for people?
Well, it really, since it came about from this these intertwining quests, really, you know, one of them being how to nourish my body, to heal my body. And finding that when I started to live out the answer to that question, it had a ripple effect on the other parts of my life. You know, I felt more connected to the deeper part of myself, that indwelling spirit. There was sort of a clearer connection with that. I was able to connect more deeply with others. And also I became more connected and concerned about the earth, you know, and about where my food was coming from and becoming a better steward of the earth, you know. There's that element. And then there's also that intertwining faith that's with all of that. And it's like this dance where as one goes deeper, the other goes deeper. As one goes deeper, the other goes deeper. And so I think that Nourished is really for anyone that is looking not just for a better way to eat, but for a richer way to live, you know?
Well, and I think what's interesting about it, even as I heard you describe it beautifully there, is so often I think in our lives, I started to say in our faith lives, but just in our lives, we don't always mean to. Sometimes we're taught to, literally, but we compartmentalize everything, and we are, you know, we speak secular, sacred, and it's we are whole people. You know, it is all all God. I mean, it is all the life of faith. It
totally.
Is all, you know, everything that you just described. And I think living the compartmentalized life does just does such a disservice to this great mystery of God and who He is in our lives.
Yes. Well, and food is such a great way to get out of that, because we have to, this is something we have to partake in
or we
several
die.
Times a day.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, and God is in it. And Jesus, I'm so struck every time I read the Bible how earthy Jesus is in terms of, you know, we see scenes of him sharing food and wine.
Right.
We see scenes of him around the table. We see scenes of him out in nature. You know, this
let alone the Lord's table that you just you allude to so beautifully. I mean, specifically,
yes.
And then allude to in other places as well.
Very, very much so. And we're called to a communion, not just with one another, but with him around the table, not just the communion table. And I think that, you know, what you were just saying about the separation, I don't believe that Jesus would really want us to separate the communion table from the dinner table as much as we have. You know, I think that they're really meant to be together in some ways.
And I think that we're called to a communion within community.
That's, oh, yes.
You know, which is that other, I think, significant piece, too.
Yeah.
So there's so much in Nourished. I mean, there's a lot of nuance there. And I mean, we've just, you know, I feel like I've plodded us through, you know, through it. But that is, the book is absolutely beautiful, beautifully written, and so much more there than we could ever do justice to in a podcast. So, thank you. Thanks for your work.
Thank
on
you,
it.
Anita. This was such a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
To everyone else, I just say keep the conversation going.